We're back. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'll remind you, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And shortly we're going to talk to Stephen Gowans. He's written a new piece. As a matter of fact, I noticed it's titled A New Gowans Article. Well, maybe that's the guy who sent it to me. U.S. Policy on Ukraine. Follow the Money. And this, of course, is dealing with something rather immediate and urgent, that where all you have to do is pick up your daily paper. And you will notice, by the way, that if you missed the Cold War, well, you didn't miss it by much, because here we go again. And speaking going again, now we have an opportunity to speak to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
How are you doing?
Good.
It's been a while. We're really glad to be talking to you, because we kind of have an urgent matter. I think Ed Herman says he's trying to figure out why Russia's borders are getting so close to our NATO bases, and he can't figure that out. You are reminding everybody that we better look at this closely, how this unfolded. And you raise the name which almost become ancient history. That is the elected president of the country, Mr. Yanukovych, back in November, said that he was going to defer a decision about an economic agreement, largely economic, you can explain it to me, with the European Union. And when he did that, all hell broke loose. And you point out in your article, U.S. Policy on Ukraine, Follow the Money, that this had something to do with the policies of the Yanukovych government, which caused hysteria in Western capitals, I gather. They say Kiev, but Washington seems pretty hysterical at the moment. Okay, go into that, if you would. What was it that they didn't like about Mr. Yanukovych?
Yeah, I mean, it's not widely recognized, as you say, that he is, or his policies are, disliked in Western capitals. The IMF certainly didn't like his policies. The IMF said that the Ukrainian economy under Yanukovych's stewardship needed to undergo structural reforms to improve the business climate. And if you look at, say, the Heritage Foundation, the Wall Street Journal, every year develop an index of economic freedom, which is essentially a rating of all countries in the world with respect to how friendly they are to Western investment. So do they embrace a free enterprise, open market, free trade agenda? So if you go and look up Ukraine on the 2014 index of economic freedom, you'll find out that the Ukraine economy under Yanukovych was rated as repressed, along with those of such perennial U.S. regime change targets as North Korea and Cuba and Zimbabwe and Venezuela and Iran. So, I mean, all of these countries are unfriendly to the idea that economic policy should be formulated to, enhance the bottom lines of people in New York and London and Frankfurt and Paris. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if you look at the 43 countries in Europe, the Index of Economic Freedom says that Ukraine's friendliness to Western corporate interests rates dead last. So people on Wall Street, people in the U.S. State Department, weren't particularly keen on the economic policies that Yanukovych was pursuing. There was a deal that he backed away from, which would have given Ukraine preferential access to European markets in return for implementing certain structural reforms in the Ukraine economy, which would make it less repressed from the perspective of Wall Street or the U.S. State Department.
Yeah, could you elaborate on that? It's interesting language, repressed. Who's being repressed other than them? What kind of limits were put on them, and what would be the result of what is going to be the result, I suppose, of the IMF approach, which apparently now everybody agrees is going to happen?
Yeah. So if you look at you look at the complaints or the grievances against the economy under Yanukovych, they'll say, well, I mean, one of the problems is that there could have been expropriation. So we didn't like that, or they didn't like that. They didn't like the fact that Ukraine still has a large number of state-owned firms, which crowds out private, or i.e. mainly Western enterprise. Kiev had restrictions on foreign investment, which were aimed at giving a leg up to domestic businesses, but they cut foreign corporations out of the action. So essentially, what was happening was that Yanukovych was limiting profit-making opportunities to North American and European corporations to the benefit of domestic firms, and also, to some extent, to the benefit of ordinary people in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to read now the IMF report on the new deal that the IMF has struck, or the new government, the new coup government has struck with the IMF. If you read their report, they talk about how they're going to now restore confidence among private investors. by private investors, they mean investors of the sort, you know, who own mansions in and around New York City and other Western financial capitals.
Not the terrible mansions in Ukraine, but
yeah, exactly.
It's only a palace when it's in Ukraine. The things they live in North America, Florida, wherever, those are not not mansions.
No. So I mean, they're talking about investors in the West. They're not talking about people in Ukraine. And so, mm-hmm. how are they going to restore confidence among private investors? Well, they're going to improve the business climate, which means they're going to hold the line on wages. They're going to lay off public sector workers. They're going to gut protections for employees, and that was one of the grievances. The labor market was inflexible. They said they're going to,
and that meant unions, right? Or laws protecting people from layoffs and that sort of thing.
Arbitrary. Yeah, exactly. And in addition, they're going to hike taxes on ordinary people through consumption taxes. They're not going to raise income tax. They're not going to raise business taxes. And in fact, they're going to implement measures to mitigate the impact of the increased consumption taxes on business. And then they're going to throw open the doors of the economy to Western corporations.
By the way, this is really quite remarkable. We're speaking to Steve Gowans, and it is gowans.wordpress.com. The title is U.S. Policy on Ukraine, Follow the Money. If you want to follow the money, by the way, you have to move quick. You know, I'm interested in your opinion or comments on this, that on the one hand, you're having an argument with a man who was elected, and suddenly overnight he's no longer there, and they have a complaint with him about his policies. But within days, everybody involved in his removal are visiting places like Brussels, Paris, London, New York, Washington, and they're talking about a new economic program, and they're signing documents. Could you describe that phenomenon? What is that? Where do they get off acting like that?
Well, I mean, yeah, and they're obviously the West agents. If you look at the Prime Minister, Yatsenyuk, and look at his website, he has a foundation, and then look at his partners. The partners, those who are contributing to his foundation, they are NATO.
NATO.
That's one of them. The
Yats has got a NATO connection.
The National Endowment for Democracy. I think the U.S. State Department. So, he's simply an extension of Washington. And he comes to power essentially by ignoring the Constitution. The Constitution is torn up. It's an illegal government. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that you can replace the president in the manner they did, which is essentially through a coup. Once the coup is successful, they immediately sign on to this deal with the IMF, which is going to redress all of the grievances that Wall Street and the U.S. State Department in Brussels had with Yanukovych's kind of foreign investor unfriendly economic policies.
And by the way, I mean, we can't fault Yats or McCain. There's no hypocrisy in the sense that they both are saying they are business people. I think Yatsenyuk says he wishes to be brutally frank and to, I forget how he put it, but he says they're going to hate me for what I do. And McCain, of course, when he says they want to be like the West, I assume he means Arizona. I mean, and they're not kidding. I'm struck by is how we're willing to kid ourselves. I mean, they are saying what they're going to do, and everybody pretends that this has something to do with Western democracy.
Well, I suppose
appropriate relations among states, etc.
I suppose it does have something to do with Western democracy if you define it in the way they do, which is, yeah, it's interesting because the IMF talks about the Yatsenyuk's government as exploiting a window of opportunity for a bold and ambitious plan to transform Ukraine into, quote,
a broken window of opportunity.
But they're going to transform Ukraine into a vibrant business environment. So we know whose interests are being looked after here.
I think I can. I smell casinos. this is Stephen Gowans, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. What about this issue? I don't know if you've been taking this up, but there does seem to be an odd problem developing, in that the U.S. is showing that its teeth here. They don't intend to retreat a step, despite all the little talks that they keep having with one another. But I want to get your thoughts on this possibility of other states, those called European states, maybe wondering if they're the ones who are going to get chewed up in the process, because how does Germany benefit, for example, from this hard-nosed U.S. policy? There must be some questions about that. What's your take on this problem, potential differences within the Western groups?
Well, yeah, I mean, if the United States continues to escalate its sanctions, I mean, Germany certainly doesn't benefit. Germany will be harmed, and as I understand it, there are many large corporations and businesses and business people in Germany who are vehemently opposed to the sanctions policies that the United States is pursuing.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that Helmut Kohl and Schrader, both, these are former leaders of Germany. Both of them say they're against this policy.
Yes. And leaders of large businesses, I mean, major businesses in Germany are opposed and have made it clear to the government that they're opposed. I suppose that the chancellor is paying lip service to mm-hmm. going along with the U.S. plan, but I'm not sure to what extent that she'll be able to support that plan.
Well, I gotta, just based on, we often speak with Rick Rozoff, stopnato.com. You're probably aware of his site, and he certainly is, he follows the NATO, and I know you watch them closely, and you just pointed out, Yats is a friend of NATO, so. What kind of personnel, we don't get reminded enough, I know you've written about it, the extension of U.S. power in Europe, they're can you give us just a rough breakdown of what kind of power they NATO American forces are found in Europe?
American forces, military forces?
Yes.
Throughout Europe? I mean, yeah, they're ubiquitous.
They are in Germany, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting about this thing. The U.S. is always worried about some poor country not being able to vote because there might be a Russian around. Apparently, everywhere in Europe, people vote with Americans around. And it's sometimes a place like Kosovo, they don't vote with American around. What is that thing called is it bond steel or something in Kosovo?
Oh, the large U.S. camp, military camp, yes.
The mystery base. We don't hear about it at all, but it is huge, apparently.
Yes. Well, I mean, the ubiquitous presence of the U.S. military in Europe always invites the question of why exactly are they there, to protect against what?
Mm-hmm.
Since they claim officially that it has nothing to do with Russia.
Yeah, the locals might ask, maybe does it have something to do with us? In Korea, you, by the way, people should follow Stephen's writings on Korea particularly. The U.S. has never left since World War II. It was supposed to be out of there. There is no Russians and no Chinese in North Korea, but there are 35,000, I believe, U.S. forces in South Korea. And if I recall your statements on this program, the commanding officer of the Korean Army is the American commanding officer.
Yeah, in state of war, it would be the United States would lead the combined forces.
I suppose that'd be true of Canada now that I think of it. But now you took up the issue, and I make sure people know this. At the end of your article on titled "U.S. Policy on Ukraine: Follow the Money," the issue of Crimea, which the U.S. said is the most horrendous case of aggression and all sorts of things. Give us your assessment of what happened there in the case of Crimea and what it represents.
Well, I mean, you could look at it as a repatriation of Crimea by Russia, since it was ceded to Ukraine by Khrushchev, as George Galloway says, without speaking to a single person in Crimea. You can regard this, I think it ought to be regarded simply as a defensive reaction by Moscow against the danger that this Russophobe coup government in Kiev would seek to eject it from its naval base on the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very important naval base for Russia. And as soon as that government came to power, there was a danger. There's a danger that they're going to try to end the lease.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about, I call them a Russophobe government.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, the groups that were involved in ousting Yanukovych, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about how they're fascistic and ultra-nationalist, and to be sure, I mean, there are fascists and ultra-nationalists involved. But there are other groups that aren't fascist and ultra-nationalist. And when you look at them, you try and find, well, what's the common element here? And you could say, well, they're all pro-European, but that's not the case because some of the fascistic groups are not pro-European at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it struck me that the common element is that they all hate Russia. They're all Russophobic groups. They hate Russia. They hate speaking
mm-hmm.
people. And I think it's interesting. That's one of the ways in which you can understand the reaction of the predominantly Russian-speaking Crimeans to the events in Kiev. And it's also one of the ways of understanding what's been going on in Donetsk and in the east of the country with the referendums there, or the referendum that just happened on Sunday. I mean, you can look at this as a backlash of Russian-speaking citizens of Ukraine against a government that hates Russians and doesn't particularly like the country's Russian speakers.
Yes. Well, now that does raise the point about this remembering that when they took power, they said some things, which, as you know, it's rather like any quarrel. Someone says something to you that's very hurtful, and then later they say, well, I didn't really mean that. You remember that they said it very clearly. And in this case, they banned parties, and they were extremely Russophobic in their rhetoric in their early days. They've toned it down slightly. However, as you say, the people in the East heard it, but of course also Moscow heard it. I recall that they definitely broached the whole subject of the lease running out for Sevastopol. And whether they like it or not, that's a serious... They should try to imagine what the Americans would say if the Cubans told them the lease ended at Guantanamo, which the Cubans are never so... they're always careful not to overdo their rhetoric on the subject. But in the case of Sevastopol, That is goes back, to, of course, to Catherine the Great, who, as you know, was KGB agent. But anyway, they can't take that lightly. That's the Black Sea. That's a whole. That is a strategic area.
Yes.
And so on that score, it strikes me that, of course, Moscow had a responsibility to guarantee that the Ukraine got the message. Well, these people claiming to be the Ukraine got the message. No, no, you can't behave like that. I want to get on to a word. You notice we're being told now we have to say separatists to describe eastern Ukraine.
Yes.
Or pro-Moscow. But in fact, they called for federalism in their own language. Why are we ignoring what they say? Or why our media is ignoring?
Yeah, well, they do, for the most part. If you read carefully, you can find something that's a lot closer to the truth. But yes, for the most part, they're almost invariably called separatists. But it's not the case that all of them want to separate. In many cases, as you said, they're looking for... well, there are a number of possibilities. As I understand it, some people have talked about... well, maybe I should back up. What's common is not separation, but what the common view is to have a self-governing or some kind of autonomy within the East. And that would be an autonomy exercised perhaps within Ukraine, perhaps as a sovereign state, or perhaps within Russia, or it could mean joining Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But if from some of the reporting that was done, and even in mainline U.S. newspapers,
mm-hmm.
when you look at what some of the people in the eastern part of Ukraine are saying, they're saying things like, my problem's not with Ukraine, my problem is with the authorities in Kiev. Or it's good to live in Ukraine, but the situation nowadays is not good for Russian-speaking people.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Kiev authorities are illegal, and people just want the right to decide for themselves. I hope everything will be peaceful within a federal Ukraine. These are things that were reported today or yesterday in the Washington Post. So if you read some of the articles carefully in some of the newspapers, you can see something different than this more common view about separatists who are,
yes,
you know, under the control of Moscow,
mm-hmm.
and being directed by Russian intelligence agents.
Yes, which, by the way, I mean, you must be struck by that, how little evidence it turns out anybody has of this.
Well, interestingly,
about every 3 days they tell us, oh, now we've got a culprit, or now we found the thumbprint, but then it turns out they found nothing.
Yeah, and interestingly, the New York Times sent some reporters into eastern Ukraine to talk to some of the militant groups there to find out if indeed they were Russian soldiers, as is often alleged. And the reporters came back and said, no, they're not. I mean, most of them have some kind of military experience, could be within the Russian military or in the Ukraine military or in the Soviet military. But there's absolutely no evidence that they could find that these were Russians,
yes,
or current serving Russian military people.
Incidentally, if you go to West Ukraine, you will find people with the same background.
Yes.
Also having served in the Soviet system and been soldiers there.
Yeah.
Now, I noticed that the only name that I can think of, well, there are two. I guess Henry Kissinger and Jimmy Carter have both said, look out, this is you're framing the story wrong. But other than that, it seems to be full bore, good old Cold War stuff. I don't know whether you've looked at that or had an essay, a picture of what Kissinger's saying. Or, what's your take on him?
No, actually, I'm not familiar with what he said about this.
Ah, well, I'm bringing this to you. How about this? We got news for Steve Gowans. No, he just simply put in a cautionary note saying that they're mischaracterizing the views of Putin, and that he doesn't see any sign of special ambition there. And by the way, I mean, isn't that, when you look at these things and we talk about the strategic point of view, how would they know, unless they're Russophobes, what Putin or his circles think is the best solution? Because a federal solution with a Yanukovych type involved in the government might be, from their point of view, the very best way to do this. And by the way, also, if you were just a friend of the Ukraine, wouldn't you say, if you want the whole entity to remain together, wouldn't you say federalization is not a bad idea? It's not going to deprive anybody of their economic or, pardon me, their and political rights. Why does it have to be a Ukraine, Western Ukraine nationalist point of view? How is that going to save anything without harming a bunch of people who don't want to do it?
No, you're right. And that option is completely politically impractical and unworkable. And I think for Ukraine, the only workable solution is some kind of federal solution. Given the nature of the ethnic divisions and cleavages within the country, there's no way it can be one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, lastly, I guess, and by the way, let's just remind everybody that this is Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com and U.S. Policy on Ukraine, Follow the Money. I really hope people go to the site, because we do need to keep in mind the larger picture. And if you could just summarize that again, your point is that there's a foundation behind all these things, NATO and ethnic preferences and all those things. Behind it is an economic interest.
Yeah, if we accept, and this is more and more accepted these days, that United States' wealthiest citizens as a class exercise inordinate influence over public policy. You even see these kinds of views expressed by people like Paul Krugman in the New York Times, who recently cited some research that was done by two political scientists that's about to be published in Perspective on Politics, which is essentially making the same point, which is who exercises influence over public policy in the United States. It's not voters, it's not ordinary people, it's the business elite. They exercise enormous influence. So if they exercise enormous influence over public policy, they exercise enormous influence over foreign policy as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that the principal function, say, the U.S. State Department and the Pentagon, is to support the overseas profit-making activities of U.S. corporations. So, when you look at interventions, U.S. interventions abroad, what lies at the root of them, in many cases, is defense and promotion of U.S. investor and corporate interests, usually against economic nationalist interests of some foreign state, for example, in Ukraine or in Zimbabwe or in Iran, or socialist interests or socialist policies, say, in Venezuela. If you look at all the countries that the United States seems to have a problem with, they're all countries that pursue economic policies that are at odds with those of, say, the United States' wealthiest citizens as a class.
Yes. I recall you pointed out on this program, we had poor Zimbabwe found diamonds, and immediately the U.S. found a way to keep them from selling their own diamonds by calling them blood diamonds.
Yes.
I don't know if that game has ever ended, but that's clearly the U.S. was mainly concerned that those diamonds had to be handled by them, by their friends in the West.
Yes, yeah. That was the reason that Yanukovych has been ousted was because he's committed the cardinal sin in the church of U.S. global hegemony, which is interfering in the profit maximization of U.S. corporations. You don't do that.
Well, that's a very nice sentence. Thank you very, very much. Steve Gowans, great to talk to you, and we look forward to talking to you sometime soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Stephen Gowans. Gowans.wordpress.com. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And in the moments remaining, Phil, we have Betsatoon. Again, we want to tell people.
Yes, on Thursday night, the film from the Toronto Palestine Film Festival called The Great Book Robbery. And you will learn about how... by the way, I don't think Israel is the only country that ever did this. A state builds up its great cultural collection and shows the world how civilized they are by appropriating forcibly the properties of those they have conquered. And in this case, the Palestinians, which had a long intellectual tradition, owned great libraries, and they all got taken away from them in 1948.
And this documentary film is going to tell
the story. Documentary film,
and the filmmaker will be there.
The filmmaker will be there, and that's Thursday night, May 15th, 7 p.m. at Betzatoon.
Phil Condon, thanks very much. Terry, thank you, and it's Phil Taylor. We'll see you next week.